From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how much difference will the new oversight board make to Milwaukee County's mental health system? Later, the Washington Post's Kevin Merida says technology helps reporting a lot, but also takes something away from it.
I sometimes worry that we're not on the ground enough and we're not picking up things organically with face-to-face human contact, and that's important to do that.
Milwaukee celebrates Shakespeare's birthday a bit early this year, but what makes him so great?
Famously said that art is the transfer of emotion from one human being to another. And I think that's what Shakespeare does. He helps us transfer emotions from one person to another.
And a Northern Michigan writer relates her tale of making ends meet, or trying to. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The effort to overhaul Milwaukee County's troubled mental health care system got a major legislative boost this year with the approval of a bill that creates an appointed board to oversee that system. Governor Walker signed the bill yesterday. Up until now, the system was the responsibility of the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. The changes come after several patient deaths at the mental health facility spurred an investigation. Those deaths and other problems at the institution were brought to light in an investigative series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called Chronic Crisis. This week, the paper and reporter Meg Kissinger are honored with a George Polk Award for medical journalism for the series. Meg Kissinger joins us in the studio to talk about an eventful year in mental health care here. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
This has been a pretty remarkable time for mental health care in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee County specifically. How significant do you think the legislation that has been passed this year is in the context of everything that's plagued the mental health system?
Well, it remains to be seen how effective it's going to be. However, that said, it blows up the status quo, which is remarkable. And so what you have had was the mental health decisions being made by politicians. And, you know, that was – they had a good reason to do that because it's – our money, our tax dollars at work. But the problem is the people making those decisions didn't have a background in mental health. And so what this law does now is it establishes a mental health board, which will by design have on it doctors, psychiatrists or psychologists, nurses, people who receive mental health care and family members. So they'll know what the heck they're talking about, or that's the hope.
But this does not mean things at the troubled mental health complex change overnight.
No. And that is such an entrenched problem. And really, it's not a problem that is unique to Milwaukee. The mental health complex is unique to Milwaukee, but poor mental health care is pretty true just about everywhere you go. What makes Milwaukee County unique, and that was the focus of this series that I worked on last year, was, you know, how much of an outlier is Milwaukee County? And the answer is, you know, while it's challenged everywhere, it's a little worse here for a lot of different reasons. And among those reasons is the rancor, the political rancor here.
Would you assert that politics is really what's to blame for being thus far unable to unpack the situation?
Well, that's putting a lot on the shoulders of politicians, so I guess I'll say no to that. You know, it's part of the reason, but mental health care, you know, is really the poor stepchild to all kinds of illnesses. So we, you know, pay attention to somebody with cancer or with heart disease or diabetes. But, you know, if somebody has schizophrenia or depression, bipolar, they're a little less lovable and a little less, you know, present on the scene.
Well, so what do you think has come together in the past 12 months to move the needle as much as it has moved?
I think there are three main reasons. You know, one of them, unfortunately, is the Sandy Hook tragedy. So that shined a big, bold light on the shortcomings, the failures of the mental health system. I have to quickly say, as an aside, a year to the day before that tragedy happened, you know, we had a story in our paper called Imminent Danger about why is it that we can't address people with serious mental illness who, by virtue of their mental illness, are dangerous. And I think that that's just the most vexing problem that we have. So anyway, that's one reason why there's such attention to that now is Sandy Hook just gave it the urgency that the situation required. And then second of all, in Milwaukee County, you know, we do have a very dysfunctional or contentious political situation with the tension between the county board and the county executive. I don't want to overplay that, but just, you know, historically, Milwaukee political systems don't work together well. And then I'll give the newspaper a little credit just because we banged the drum and, you know, we're not supposed to brag. And I'm just proud that our newspaper devoted this kind of resource to this issue because it's an unloved issue. It's a hard issue to love. Let me put it that way.
Well, and you're not supposed to brag, but we should point out that this week you'll be honored with a Polk Award, which is a pretty big deal.
Well, that's nice, and I'm so happy for the attention to that issue because, again, I've been writing about mental health for decades, and I was writing about it alone for a lot of years. And I'm happy to have the company now because it's quite a serious and pervasive problem.
There's been a lot of rub going back to the issue of Sandy Hook about whether progress was made in terms of gun laws coming out of it, but somewhat less attention has been paid to its fallout and the fallout of other events in terms of mental health laws.
Right. That's the ancient tension, between, first of all, why are we doing this? Is this enhancing our mental health system being done at the expense of not addressing gun control? And that's a legitimate question to ask. And my quick answer to that is it doesn't really matter if you're somebody clamoring for improvements in mental health care. You'll take it wherever you can get it. And they certainly do need improvements in mental health care.
Well, and I wonder if in your reporting you also see attention in terms of the attention paid to mental health issues versus other medical issues as being a question of, you know, if this were an infectious disease or a disease that people imagined they might catch, it would be one thing. But you're talking about an issue that for some people is about somebody else.
Correct. Actually, it's not that much about somebody else if you really scratch the surface. I mean, it's staggering, the incidence of mental health, you know, mental illness that in this country that we're just now starting to appreciate and realize. I just saw a report about the 40% of inmates in Rikers Island in New York are now considered to have mental illness. You know, I would say it's probably higher than that, and they're surprised that it's that high, just misunderstood. And we're still in the infancy about what we know about mental illness. And there isn't a blood test or an X-ray. So, you know, whereas other things are much easier to diagnose, that's one thing. The stigma of mental illness is quite another, and that prohibits a lot of people from talking about it freely. So that's, I guess, you know, what I've really tried to do with my stories is to just shine that light. And you know, what I can do is, as a reporter, is to kind of bear witness to the suffering and pain of people with mental illness and the inability of our system here in Milwaukee to address that.
In the near future, this mental health advisory board is going to come together. How contentious a process would you imagine that is going to be?
I hope it's not contentious at all because their mission really is to give advice. So they're going to be given, you know, a budget, and they make the decisions about how mental health programs are funded. So, I think by drawing from all aspects of the question of who needs care and how to deliver that, they can do a better job than wrangling by politicians.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what its first move is once it comes together. And I'm sure it will be something we will read about with a Meg Kissinger byline.
That would be the hope.
Well, thank you so much and congratulations.
Mitch, thank you. Thank you.
Meg Kissinger is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her work on the series Chronic Crisis about the county's mental health system receives a George Polk Award for medical journalism this week in New York. A former Milwaukee Journal reporter has gone on to big things in an uncertain climate for print journalism. We'll chat with Kevin Merida, the managing editor of the Washington Post, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. While he didn't grow up here, journalist Kevin Merida cut his teeth as a journalist, as a beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal in the late 1970s and early 80s. After a stint at the Dallas Morning News, Merida joined the Washington Post, where he stayed for more than two decades. His work has ranged from covering presidential campaigns and Congress to a landmark series for the paper called Being a Black Man. He's co-authored books on Clarence Thomas and Barack Obama. Merida is now managing editor for news and feature coverage at the Post and was keynote speaker at an event late last month co-sponsored by Marquette University and the Public Policy Forum. He joined us in the Lake Effect studio. Nice to have you here.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you.
So your first reporting job was at the Milwaukee Journal back in the late 70s, early 80s. Can you contrast what your life was like as a reporter in that period with the work that you see your team doing at the Post today?
Well, it was a great training ground for me. I a lot of tremendous reporters. That's my first job coming out of college. I love being in Milwaukee. That was a time when it was a great blue-collar ethic here. It was an afternoon paper, so it was something different. The kind of work that I was interested in was really investigative work and also community work. And so, you know, I remember doing a piece about a playground. I remember doing a drug investigation about a big drug ring that was kind of operating out of the underground. You know, I remember looking into dog fighting and spending a lot of time and nights trying to track down that organized dog fighting in Milwaukee. So, you know, I did a range of different work, general assignment work, and it really gave me a good foundation.
Are general assignment reporters today in a place like the Washington Post – are they doing the same kinds of things that a general – I mean, the news staffs in general were much larger places in those days. Is there more specialization or less specialization than there was in those days?
Well, I think there's more specialization, but we're in a different age. One of the things I do worry about is just the notion of going out on the streets in the neighborhoods and in communities and just talking to people. You know, we used to always say in journalism school, there's no news in a newsroom. And because of the technological advance and there's so much you can do, people conduct interviews by email, there's so much data and charts, you can do some really compelling work and never have to leave your office. And it's work that we need to be done. But I sometimes worry that we're not on the ground enough and we're not picking up things organically with face-to-face human contact, and that's important to do that. And we still have some reporters that cruise. I like to see reporters cruising and just stopping in places where without a scheduled appointment, you know, just to find out what's going on, like Marvin Gaye used to say.
Well, yeah, I wonder as a managing editor how you foster that kind of shoe leather sort of work.
Well, I think just encourage it. And, you know, I've said that this is the year of ambition, you know, to all of our reporters. And ambition in a lot of ways. I mean, we do have to be digitally ambitious too because that's the era we're living in. We have to come up with new storytelling techniques. We have to find ways to engage readers on their smartphones. And so that's all important. But ambition ought to be separating yourselves from your competitors any way you can. And I do think that there's a lot of stories out there to be told. You know, the whole country, the economy has changed the way people dream now. You know, aspirations have changed. Demographic shifts in the country have led to, you know, kind of upending communities and upending our politics. And there's just lots of stories underneath the surface that need exploration. And you can't do all of that by computer and sitting at your desk.
Well, and competition has to be a different animal as well. I mean, when you were reporting for here in Milwaukee, this was a two daily newspaper town, and today, you know, Washington is a two paper town. But you're in competition with other newspapers. You're in competition with Facebook. You're in competition with everything. How does competition allow? How does the nature of competition allow you to keep your eyes on the prize, if you will?
Well, that's exactly right, Mitch. I mean, everyone's our competitor. Google's our competitor. Twitter's our competitor. Everybody who's sharing work is our competitor, because you want to create work that's shared. But I do think that one of the things that we notice is that the more competitors, and particularly with the specialized natures, we are able to separate ourselves on the really big, important, large stories. I mean, you know, the Snowden documents that we had a share of those along with The Guardian, it opened up a whole discussion back in the country and in the world about the nature of surveillance and privacy and civil liberties. I don't know that a lot of news organizations would have been able to know what to do with that material and would have handled it and would have had the experts to sift through it the way we did. The healthcare law, which is important, affects, you know, millions and millions of Americans, affects everyone. We've been all over that. You know, we've been on the how it's being rolled out. There's an accountability role in which we make sure that the government is doing what it says it will do. And when things like Newtown happen, I must say people flock to us because they want to have information that's reliable, Navy Yard shooting. And they want journalism they can trust. And I think that's one of the things that we continue to bring and separate ourselves is our authority, the confidence that readers can have in us, and knowing that we're going to be fast, we're going to try to be current, we're going to try to continue to innovate, but we're also going to be have those values of authority and reliability and expertise.
When your audience is really worldwide, do you have to change what you think of as the concept of local news? I mean, is the idea of local news almost an outdated concept?
Well, I think for the people in communities, they still want to know about each other. And so I think as long as we're anchored in Washington, D.C., and we are responsible for I think people see us responsible for the region. I think we'll always have local news. You know, when there's a shooting at the Columbia Mall, that's local. You know, and sure, there were other people who picked that up, but it's a very much a local story. Also, it's the Nationals are a local story. The Redskins are a local story. And there's been a lot of corruption in city government. Well, that's a local story. And that kind of reporting, that attention to that is going to be always a focus of ours, along with all of the other kind of national and international reporting we do.
Well, let me take an example. As we have this conversation, we can go to the Washington Post's website, and there right at the front page is a video featuring an interview with a Democrat running for Senate in Maine. Do you see – is the audience for a feature like that and other kinds of coverage like that, is that an audience that's around the world? Do you hope that someone in Maine gets something out of it that's distinct from what the Post brings to an equation like that?
Well, what we hope is that whatever – if we're writing about a candidate in Maine, that we're really telling something about the story of the election, the candidate or the race – has an echo that will resonate in other places, that there's a storyline behind our illustrations, a larger story. And that's what we're really trying to do, stories that sure, I hope people in Maine will read it, but also that it will resonate all over the country and maybe in places that are concerned and interested in American politics. And that's a lot of places around the world. They're very interested in our government, interested in who occupies the White House. They're interested in Congress. I mean, when you see a place like the nation's capital, everybody comes there. It's one place that everybody, I don't care who you are, you can't escape it. You know, if you're a billionaire, there's going to probably be an antitrust issue. You know, actors, celebrities come and advocate causes to Congress. Diplomats from all over the world come there, and it's the capital still of the world. And so our kind of owning the coverage of that, and I think we do more than any other news organization, I think that's brings people to us.
There are many, many different forms of journalism that exist today that weren't even dreamed of when you were getting your start at the Milwaukee Journal. There are bloggers, social media journalists, multimedia journalists, general assignment reporters, the entire spectrum. As you visit with journalism students in Milwaukee, what do you see as the right training ground for journalists today?
Well, it's wide open. I mean, it's a great time. The first thing I say, particularly to the young people, that it's a great profession to enter. And I want it to be a magnet profession again, like it was when I went to school in the post-Watergate era, when everyone wanted to be like Woodward and Bernstein. There was a glamour to investigative reporting. But now the digital age continues to create jobs. The median age at the Washington Post is younger than it's ever been. And that'll continue to be the case because we have young people with different skill sets. They've grown up in a period where things that are digital are natural to them. That is part of their natural DNA. And we're all trying to create more digital DNA in our newsrooms. People who have the instinct to have different, try out different storytelling forms, interactive graphics, embedded developers, that's a job. People who know audience, and we have audience engagement teams. We have a range of different kind of work that we're doing that opens up a newsroom. And so you still need to have the fundamentals, the judgment. You need to know about values and ethics and all of the things that we always needed to know. But there's just a range of different skills that a lot of people are bringing in to our profession now, and we welcome.
We hear a lot about the relatively low esteem in which many people view journalists. What has to happen to return journalism to this kind of, if not exalted, certainly a profession that's looked up to?
Well, I think they have a greater distrust of politicians than we cover. But you know, I think, you know, I don't know about the esteem. I know that people have feelings about how we do our jobs and thinks we're sometimes intrusive. But, you know, whenever there's a big story where they're going to tune in, when the Malaysian airplane goes down, they want to know what's going on. They tune in to us. When any kind of tragedy, when anything happens around the world, typhoons, mudslides, the need to know brings people to journalism. And so I think that we have a place in society. You know, it's not necessarily to be loved, but it is to be to help to educate and chronicle and enlighten. And I think we do a good job overall. The business has changed, and, you know, I'm not one of the people who want to weed people out of the craft and say, you know, you're not a journalist, you're not a journalist, you're not a journalist. You know, the definition of what a journalist is expanding, and if people want to call themselves journalists, they can. I know at the Washington Post we do a kind of journalism that I think that people have come to us for 8 decades, and I think they'll continue to come to us.
Is there something that newspapers ought to be doing to better reach out to the next generation of would-be readers?
Well, I think to try to write about and produce journalism that people want to share. I mean, I think part of the culture here is that a lot of, you know, I have young people. I have two sons. You know, one's 31, one's 28, and another is 18. And so they're part of this millennial culture. And you know, they're going to different sites. They're not going to just the Washington Post. That's not their homepage. They're basically drawn by work that moves them, engages them. So that is everything as small as writing better headlines. That's everything from creating, trying different forms, more explainers, more video, more graphics, more Q&As. And it's also trying to understand the generation that is coming up now. I mean, reporting on them and in a way that feels sophisticated and engaging. And so I think we've always, you know, had, you know, I don't think we started out saying, well, our business is just for older people, senior citizens, our moms. But trying to reach people is about both subject, but it's also about form. And I think that's what the lessons of this time teaches.
Well, Kevin Merida, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank you, Mitch.
Kevin Merida is managing editor at The Washington Post in charge of news and feature coverage. His professional journalism career started at the Milwaukee Journal in the late 1970s. He was back in Milwaukee recently to keynote an event held by the Public Policy Forum and Marquette University. The Bard turns a youthful 450 this year. We'll hear about a celebration ahead of that momentous occasion when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. We're celebrating National Poetry Month throughout April, and when you think of some of the greatest poetry in the English language, many minds go immediately to Shakespeare. Coincidentally, the Bard's birthday is later this month on a day many scholars agree is the 23rd of April, also his death day, 52 years later. Milwaukee's celebration of Shakespeare's birthday comes a little early this year thanks to the friends and alumni of Marquette English at Marquette University. They'll throw a Shakespeare sonnet slam beginning at 5 o'clock this afternoon. C.J. Ribal is the organizer of the event and the Louise Edna Godin Professor of English at Marquette. He talked with Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about the upcoming 450th birthday.
He doesn't look a day over 350, really, does he?
Exactly. Well, why do you think, after all these years, that Shakespeare and his writing still endure?
Well, I think it's because he tapped so many human emotions, really almost the full gamut, and did it so well in such terrific language that writers to this day are still aspiring to hit the mark that he set so many years ago. I mean, you know, if you talk to writers, they want to aspire, I think, to that. And I think audiences respond because he speaks to something directly to them. Somebody once famously said that art is the transfer of emotion from one human being to another. And I think that's what Shakespeare does, is he helps us transfer emotions from one person to another.
You talked about the importance of his language, and that language is going to be on display today at an event. Can you tell me a little bit about the origins behind the Shakespeare Sonnet Slam?
Sure. The friends and alumni of Marquette English, the FAME, as we call ourselves, but Marquette University as a whole, has always wanted to celebrate both National Poetry Month, but also great writing in all its forms. And we settled on celebrating Shakespeare's birthday. And each year we've had a different kind of celebration. We've had James DeVita from American Players Theater perform his one-man show enacting Shakespeare. We had a scholar from Opera Magazine talk about Shakespeare and the opera. And we thought this year would be a terrific idea to have people from around the Milwaukee community and Marquette to all read short excerpts or sonnets of Shakespeare's and to do them just kind of lickety-split. I mean, a sonnet only takes about a minute, minute and a half to read. So we're getting 26 people up and reading one sonnet after another or very short excerpt from famous speeches. And it'll all take place within an hour, starting at 5 p.m. today.
That's a lot of Shakespeare.
It is a lot of Shakespeare. But I think people are really excited about it. We've gotten tremendous response from the various people who have agreed to attend and appear.
Who are some of the highlights?
We've got Mayor Tom Barrett, County Executive Chris Abele, UWM's own Dr. Margaret Newton, who's actually going to be reading the To Be or Not to Be speech from Hamlet in Ojibwe, followed by Kyle Connor doing Hamlet, who's actually Hamlet himself, is appearing in the Marquette University Helfer Theater production of Hamlet that evening, and he'll come and perform as well. We'll have Mark Sablejack from the Milwaukee Business Journal. We will have Joel Brennan from Discovery World, John Gerda, local historian, Mike Goucher, Jesse Garcia, UWM's own Mitch Teich. Everybody is reading a short excerpt of Shakespeare. We'll also have musicians from the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra doing a short musical interlude of Renaissance music. So it's going to be a fabulous packed hour.
Do people often realize how much poetry is in the plays and the speeches?
Well, there's so many, you know, famous lines that get spoken out of context, you know, and people don't even realize they're quoting Shakespeare. You know, the famous "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers," which gave rise to a HBO series about warriors and based on a book, is actually from the St. Crispin's Day speech that Chris Abele is going to be reading tonight. The phrase "and thereby hangs a tale" comes from Shakespeare. That's Mark Sablejack is going to be reading that speech. Phrases like "when in disgrace with fortune in men's eyes" will be read. There's just so many, I think, phrases. "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?" You know, he was so good at language. I think it just has percolated into our everyday use, and we don't even realize it comes from Shakespeare anymore. And that's one of the things that makes him great, is he was writing not just for the people, you know, in the more expensive seats. He was writing for the people who could barely pay to get in, what they were known as the groundlings, the people who sat on the ground, the rabble, which is also why even his very serious plays like Hamlet have comedic moments in them. He's playing to the audience as well.
Is there something about hearing Shakespeare and seeing Shakespeare performed versus reading it, which I think is how so many of us these days are introduced to him?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, there is something to actually hear the words made live. It's one of the reasons why actually one of the things we're suggesting to people, too, if they have a chance to come for the Party for the Bard, and then if they want to kind of binge on the Bard a little bit, that evening at 7:30, Hamlet will be performed at the Helfer Theater, so they can actually hear Hamlet spoken live. And it's quite amazing. I've seen that production. It's very good.
Well, why do you think it's important to have an event like this honoring the Bard and his work?
Well, I think we get caught up in our day-to-day lives of just kind of the drudgery of just, you know, getting from point A to point B and following through on our schedules. And I think it's terrific to be reminded from time to time of the beauty and the awe of the world. And I think that's one of the things that poetry offers us. It's one of the things certainly that Shakespeare offers us, and to remind us of how alike we are and how motivated we are by this entire range of emotions that he captures so well.
Now, does this event take into account at all the controversial theory that Shakespeare didn't actually exist, or perhaps was just a name that other writers wrote under?
It doesn't, because we assume that, in fact, Shakespeare was Shakespeare. The theory that he was somebody else is, I think, largely promulgated by the idea that somebody who came from relatively humble beginnings could not possibly have had this command of the language or have this knowledge of the court. And I think that's simply an elitist sort of opinion. And I think most Shakespeare scholars have concluded as well that is a red herring, really.
Is there a certain amount of hype that comes these days with Shakespeare? I mean, does he still live up to the lofty stature that his name now evokes?
I think he does. And I think a good way of looking at it is this being the 450th year of his birth. You go to Broadway in New York City, and there were just an amazing number of productions of Shakespeare this past year with record-setting attendances. I was able to actually go to one of the performances, Twelfth Night, when I was out there. And it's amazing to see how alive this work still is and still speaks to us. I mean, the whole range of human emotions, love, jealousy, greed, humor, distemper, everything is out there on display and presented to us in ways that I think open us up to the possibilities of the human imagination.
Well, I think I'll spare our audience me channeling my sixth grade Orsino in Twelfth Night. If music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it. I'll stop there. But CJ, you have a little something to read for us.
Yes, I'll read Sonnet 18, which is one of those, you know, oldies but goodies. And it's about actually the way in which people eventually pass, but they are kept alive in our memories and particularly are kept alive in our art. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and oft is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
CJ Ribal, thank you.
Thank you.
C.J. Ribal is the Louise Edna Godin Professor of English at Marquette University and the organizer of the Shakespeare Sonnet Slam in honor of the Bard's 450th birthday. The event gets underway at 5 o'clock on the fourth floor of the Engineering Hall and features some notable Milwaukeeans reading their favorite sonnets. You can find a link to more from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A short break now, and when we return, we meet a writer and farmer from northern Michigan whose recent book tells the tale of her real-life struggle to save her family's farm. That's ahead when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's the quintessential American idea of resilience, pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps. But that metaphorical action may be harder than it once was, thanks to an economy that remains tough in many areas. It was especially tough for northern Michigan writer Marty Jo Link in the summer of 2005, when circumstances put her, her family, and her farm on the brink. Fortunately for her, she made it through that situation, and it inspired a memoir called Bootstrapped, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. The paperback edition of the book is just out. She joined us last year. Marty Link, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
The year that this book represents seems like an incredible confluence of events, but yet, did you feel like there was something – was there something universal in your experiences that you imagine people could relate to, if not the them in their sum total?
I think an awful lot did happen to us that year. And if I would have known that all those things were on their way, I might have made some different decisions. But I didn't. And so I just sort of dealt with things as they arrived. But really all of those things – the weather was a big factor, the cold in northern Michigan, feeding ourselves – having some mechanical problems, all of those are pretty common. For rural people, it just doesn't always happen in one 12-month period.
Well, and we should, for people who have not yet read the book, paint a picture of this little farm, homestead, if you will, in northern Michigan where you live.
Right, right. Well, it was 6 acres with a century-old farmhouse. As a matter of fact, on the deed, it says year built, plus or minus 1900. So it's not even recorded what year it was built. So it's old and drafty, but Victorian and beautiful, and a pretty bucolic setting about 8 miles south of Traverse City, Michigan.
When you first moved there, it must have been beautiful and sustainable, more easily sustainable.
It was. The idea was sort of to have a hobby farm, a place where the kids could play, where I could have horses, where we could have a big garden. And it was never intended to sustain a family of four.
And as the book opens, you have at that point just separated from your husband, who takes up residence across the street.
Right. Right. And at the time, that seemed perfectly logical. It seems so silly now, but it was easier for the kids. And we were both pretty devoted parents. Despite the fact that our marriage was ending, we both were pretty devoted parents. And so it seemed like it was one of those, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
I imagine there are probably a lot of people, maybe you've heard from some of them, who have read this and said, well, this would have been such a much easier time if she had just downsized when this all happened. Why was it so important for you and your family to stay on this piece of property?
Well, that had been a lifetime dream of mine. I grew up in a suburb, the northern Detroit suburbs, and I just sort of promised myself that when I was a parent, when I was a mom, I was going to raise my children in the way that I wished that I would have been. I wished that I had open land and farm animals and the smell of hay and all of that. And that's what I wanted for my kids. And I think I was not willing to give that up.
Well, and so aside from the separation and the imminent divorce, give people a flavor for just what you were up against, because there are a lot of people who go through tough times like this, but it really, from the get-go, it seemed like the deck was stacked against you.
Right. I was working as a freelance writer, so an editor, certainly nobody is going to, if someone wants to make a big income, that wouldn't be top on their list of careers. So I was doing that. My sons were growing and active. They were 8, 12, and 15, so they had pretty big caloric requirements as well as they were busy. And in the area that I live in, it's a small town. There aren't a lot of job prospects. And this was 2005, so it was just the beginning of the downward spiral that hit Michigan particularly hard. And so I was up against making a mortgage that was predicated on two people's incomes and also feeding us, keeping the house warm, and keeping us mentally stimulated, and just also healing my own broken heart.
You write a lot about how your kids got through that period. It seems from an outsider's perspective that if not for their resilience, this would have been an even harder year.
Oh, I think they are definitely the heroes of the story. They did everything I asked of them and more. And, you know, I gave them this book to read when it was in manuscript form, and I had asked their permission if I could write about them. And they said, well, we don't understand why anybody would be interested in our lives, Mom, but sure, go ahead. And when they read the manuscript, they said, you know, we remember all of these things happening. We remember the freezer breaking. We remember the zucchini contest. We remember that big, long driveway that we shoveled. But we weren't scared. We didn't even know you were worried. We didn't think that we were in distress. And so looking back, I think that might have been my biggest accomplishment that year, is that I protected my children from adult worries.
I was going to say that would seem to be the biggest testament to your resilience in getting through this and the power that you actually still had, even as you might have felt powerless.
I think when other people's lives are in your hands, you have that extra sense of responsibility. I have to do this not just for myself, but for them too. And, you know, there was also a lot of humor that year, and we did have some good moments, a lot of good moments that made up at some point for the desperation that I was feeling.
You mentioned the zucchini contest, mm-hmm. and that was maybe the scene that stuck out most in my mind even well after having read this book. Tell us what led you to become an impromptu zucchini farmer.
Right. Well, I didn't even plant zucchini because, as any gardener knows, you don't really have to. Even if you plant a single plant, you'll be overrun. So I hadn't planted any of that. And then after we didn't have horses on the farm anymore, one day, my youngest son came into the house crying, and I went out to investigate. Well, he and his brother had taken up their battle positions in the pasture, which was now empty of livestock, but had these just horrifically large zucchini plants growing, and the kids were not harvesting them for our dinner. They were heaving them at each other like bombs. And so I immediately halted that. We had a discussion about how important our food was. And just by coincidence, I saw a little poster up at the bakery that said zucchini contest. And first prize was $100 worth of baked goods. So I assigned the boys to each select one of those giant zucchinis and take care of it for the next week or so. And then we entered them into the contest.
And it turned out that you had raised not just a zucchini, but and not even just a prize-winning zucchini, but maybe the ultimate prize-winning zucchini.
They were so huge, and they weren't – I think they must have been some kind of strange hybrid, because zucchinis are dark green with darker green stripes, and these were a real pale green with dark green stripes. So there's a squash called delicata that I think maybe might have intermingled with some strange zucchini. But the bakery didn't mind, and they ended up giving us first and second place. And that really was our bread for the year.
Right, because I think you're right that you had been taking advantage of this bakery already, because they would sell essentially day old baked goods at a lower price.
Right. Yeah, and I was raised by a mother who made all of our bread from scratch, and yet this bakery, it was even less expensive to buy their bread at half price the next day than it was to make it myself. So that's what I did.
At some level, do you feel as though you have written a how-to manual in a way, you know, how to get by when everything seems stacked against you?
I think somewhat. I mean, I think there is some practical lessons in there. And ultimately, I think we didn't necessarily solve all of our financial problems as much as outlast them. You know, I'm pretty stubborn, and we just continued to put our finger in the dike for a year until things got better and until my income increased.
It is a pretty remarkable story of resilience, considering everything that you went through. And we didn't mention everything: broken well, you had vehicular problems.
Right.
You mentioned the horses that started the year with you and finished the year not with you.
Right.
Your efforts to raise chickens. I wonder, now that you are a few years removed from this experience, do you hold any resentment today towards how hard society makes it for people trying to scrape by?
I don't know if it's necessarily resentment. You know, I think there is this myth that people who are poor put themselves in that position and are uneducated, and I think that's false. It could happen to any of us. And that's what was so shocking to me. I mean, I was raised in suburbia by an intact family. I have a college degree, and I even have some post-college classes. And yet, you know, I had traveled to Europe and everything else, and yet it happened to me. I think it could happen to anybody. And most people don't realize that. I certainly didn't before it did happen to me.
Was it hard to revisit that time of your life when you sat down to write this?
It was hard. It was particularly difficult to think about the kids and their trajectory that year. And being a former journalist, you know, we're trained not to ever use that word "I." In any byline you see in the newspaper, it has the reporter's name, but just the facts, ma'am, sort of. And so getting over that hurdle was difficult. But ultimately, it was incredibly satisfying to make meaning out of what essentially at that time for me seemed meaningless and seemed endless. And to take that and revisit it and see it into the larger context of our lives was pretty satisfying.
How do you think that year shapes who you are today and maybe who your kids are today?
Well, my sons are all doing just fantastically well. My older one is now a sous chef in Chicago. He's 23, and he never went to cooking school. He just did it all by experience and hard work. So, of course, I'm proud of him for that.
Does he use a lot of zucchini?
He probably does. He uses a lot of local. He really knows what's in season and how to prepare it. I'm sure that helped him get the job. And he left home at 19 and really never looked back. My middle son is also working in – he's a full-time college student, but for the summer he's cooking also at a restaurant in Traverse City. And my younger son just got a job dishwashing at the same restaurant. And I was eating there last week for lunch, and the chef came up to me and he said, "Hey, do you have any more?" And I think I raised hardworking kids, and that is going to do them well for the rest of their lives. And for myself, I know the value of hard work, But I think we've lost the connection to physical labor. We're all with our texting and our technology and all of that, which is fine. You know, I have a Facebook page. I text. But there is a place for that. And there's also still a place to be in touch with what physical labor can do for you.
In a strange way, are you glad that you went through the year that you went through?
You know, I kind of am. And it of course, it made a great story, I think. You know, we don't want to read the story. It started out fine and ended up fine. That's just not – as Americans, though, that's not the kind of story we want to read. But it did give me a sense of how important my family is to me. And I'm sure, you know, we all think our family is important. But when we needed to rely on each other, we did. And we know that about each other now. And without that year, we wouldn't have known that maybe quite so deeply.
There does seem like a certain delicious degree of irony in the fact that you can, in part, earn a living from writing a book about how hard it was to earn a living.
I know. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? You take the thing that was hardest and turn it into something helpful, I suppose. But yeah, believe me, I have thought about that irony many times.
Better to have the irony than not, I suppose.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I hadn't even thought of writing a memoir, really. And I, as a matter of fact, when I was approached to do this, I ended up going to the library and checking out a big stack of memoirs to read and find out what I liked and what I thought worked and what didn't. And what struck me is that at the end of reading all of that, I thought, you know, the parts that stick with me are probably the parts that were hardest for the author to write. And so I tried to keep that in mind when I was writing my own and revealing parts about my own life.
Well, and with that in mind, what was the part that you found hardest to write about this?
Probably the holding back from the boys, you know, trying to continue to make their childhood fun and keeping from them the dangerous and more frightening aspects. I didn't want them to know how close we were really to failure.
There is a really moving scene where you're at a county fair and the length that you went to make sure that they were still able to have fun. We won't give it away necessarily,
right.
But it is a scene that will stay with anybody who reads it for a long time, I think.
Thank you. Well, you know, you hope that when you're put in situations like that, you do the brave thing, but you don't know until you are.
Well, it's a remarkable read, and thanks for sharing at least a snapshot of it with us, Marty Link.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Come back and see us again.
I'd like to.
Marty Link is the author of Bootstrapped, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm, which has just come out in paperback. She lives in northern Lower Michigan, and our interview first aired last year. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Thursday on the show, we'll get an update on Milwaukee's Violence Prevention Initiative. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, as it is every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.